This is Audible.
The Eyes of the Sphinx, the newest evidence of extraterrestrial contact in ancient Egypt, by Eric von Daniken. Flooding and lifting. Professor Riedel of Vienna solved the mystery of the pyramids without rockers or ramps, without 100,000 workers, and without hocus pocus. How were the 40 and 50-ton granite beams transported from Aswan to Giza? On barges? Not a chance, says Professor Riedel. Under barges. Riedel remembered the ancient mathematician Archimedes, born 278 BC, who invented not only the Archimedean screw, but also a number of clever war machines. It is said that this mathematical and practical genius realized one day, while swimming, that his body weighed less in water than on land. We call it buoyancy. At some point, after yet another granite beam fell off a barge into the water, the Egyptian builders must have come to the same conclusion. Stones weigh less underwater. Professor Riedel claims that the Egyptians tied the heavy loads under the water surface between two boats. To do that, the ships were anchored and flooded with water until the load was securely fastened underwater. Then the barges were emptied by hundreds of busy hands so that they bobbed up to the surface, simultaneously raising the granite beams attached to them. Theoretically, Riedel's suggestion is quite sensible. Whether it would have been feasible on a 1,000-kilometer journey up the Nile through shallow water and rapids would have to be demonstrated in an experiment using ancient Egyptian barges. The minimum weight for each stone beam would have to be 45 tons, because the raw monoliths were bigger than the finished beams after they were polished. Once they arrived in Giza, the barges were directed into a specially designed harbor, where they were flooded once more, causing the load to sink to the bottom. The monoliths, which were still attached to ropes, were then hauled onto the sleds by a crew of workmen. It is even possible that the sleds were placed underwater beforehand so that the stones could be lowered directly onto the sleds. Professor Riedel does not believe that the sleds were dragged along an endless ramp by hundreds of swearing and sweating workers, but rather that they were moved with the help of stationary winches. He imagines an array of winches positioned all over the plain at Giza. The horizontal turnstiles were driven by men or oxen. The sleds were moved from one winch to the next until they reached the foot of the pyramid, where the stones were loaded onto wooden lifting platforms. Professor Riedel suggests 20 such platforms, each with a length of 5 meters on each side of the pyramid. The principle is simple and works just as easily as the practical devices used by window washers on skyscrapers, without ramps, scaffolds, or piles of sand. Several pulleys are mounted on each completed terrace of the pyramid. The ropes hanging down from the pulleys are attached to a long wooden platform, which in turn has a crank-operated pulley on each end. If one pulley is operated, the wooden platform is lowered on one side. The stone monolith can be pried off the sled and onto the platform. The load is secured with a stop. A few men turn the crank or turnstile, and the slanting platform is gradually lifted into a horizontal position. Then the pulleys move the load, as well as the workers, up to the next terrace of the pyramid. It reminds me of Laurel and Hardy attempting to paint the outside of a house. Their paint bucket slides down the slanting platform and crashes to the ground. Professor Riedel's theory is excellent. It explains the construction of the pyramids without miracles and magic, if, indeed, the conditions for this kind of building process could be met. Large quantities of wood would have been required for the barges and the submarine transport of the stones, as well as for the countless sleds, winches, pulleys, and lifting platforms. Ultimately, Professor Riedel's theory would have been doomed by the requisite yards and yards of finest quality rope, without which no winch would have turned and no platform would have climbed the pyramid walls. The pyramid builders supposedly had hemp rope. Hemp rope? At best, hemp rope would be able to sustain a load of 2 or 3 tons. How many ropes would have been required to lift a 50-ton monolith? At what point would the rope have snapped off the round wheel? At what point would the thin rope have been shredded on the turnstiles? At what point would the lifting platform have crashed down from the 96th terrace, splintering the edges of the carefully inserted lower-level stones? It is unlikely that the construction of the pyramid could have proceeded without accidents, yet there is no indication that crashing boulders damaged any parts of the growing edifice. Did the ancient Egyptians have the necessary expertise about pulleys and these rather sophisticated lifting platforms in Khufu's times, 2551 BC? One would think that if the answer is affirmative, the succeeding generations of pharaohs would have had the same kind of technology. Why would Khufu's successors build such pitifully small pyramids if the technology was already available and construction was a cinch with the pulleys and lifting platforms? Consider Pharaoh Nuisere, 2420 to 2396 BC, for example, who lived merely 130 years after completion of the Great Pyramid, and whose reign was slightly longer than that of his predecessor, Khufu. He had the same amount of time to build his pyramid, and one would think that construction technology had actually improved in the 130 years since Khufu. Builders and architects learn much in such a time span. However, Nuisere's pyramid at Abu Sir measures a mere 51.5 meters in height. The pyramid of his predecessor, Sahure, 2458 to 2446 BC, is only 47 meters high, which is still 4 meters higher than the diminutive pyramid of Pharaoh Yunus, 2355 to 2325 BC, who was also in the 5th dynasty. Egypt offers a great number of pyramids, step pyramids, unfinished pyramids, and collapsed pyramids. Nowhere have archaeologists found even a trace of a rotted platform or a mounting block for a pulley. Concrete that lasts for centuries. Who cares? Says Professor Joseph David Davits, director of the Institute for Applied Archaeological Science at Barry University in Miami, Florida. The Egyptians did not get the stones for the Great Pyramids in Aswan or in any other quarry, nor did they hoist them around with pulleys. They poured them at the construction site, just like concrete. Wow! The evidence submitted by Professor David Davits, a chemist, has all the trimmings of a mystery novel. It goes like this. In 1889, the Egyptologist C.E. Wilbur found a stele covered with hieroglyphs on the tiny Nile island of Sahil, north of Aswan. Sahil is one of the few places in Egypt where one can see the ancient Egyptian gods immortalized in splendid inscriptions in the rock. The inscriptions were translated in the last century by the archaeologists Brugsch, Plate, and Morgan, and again in 1953 by the French Egyptologist Barkit. The experts agree that the hieroglyphs on the famous famine stele date to the era of the Ptolemies, around 300 BC, although the text itself recounts a time 1,000 years earlier. Of the 2,600 hieroglyphs found on the stele, 650 describe the manufacture of artificial stones. It is said that Khnum, the ancient Egyptian god of creation, imparted this knowledge to Pharaoh Djoser, 2609 to 2590 BC, the builder of the first pyramid, in a dream. It must have been a strange dream, because Khnum dictated a list of 29 minerals and various natural chemicals to the pharaoh, and also showed him the naturally occurring binding agents needed to fuse the artificial stones together. Pharaoh Djoser, the builder of the Step Pyramid of Saqqara, was not the only one to receive such divine messages. The same thing happened to his chief architect, Imhotep, who later was worshipped like a god in Egypt, and whose tomb archaeologists have never been able to locate. Columns 6 through 18 on the famine stele listed the ingredients necessary to make concrete and the sites where these ingredients could be found. Following these divine instructions, Imhotep mixed natron, sodium carbonate, and clay, aluminum silicate, and combined them with additional silicates and aluminous Nile mud. By adding arsenic minerals and sand, Imhotep obtained a quick-drying cement with the molecular structure of natural stone. At the Second International Conference of Egyptologists, held in 1979 in Grenoble, France, Dr. D. Clem, a mineral expert, astounded the incredulous archaeologists with his analyses of pyramid stones. Dr. Clem and his scientists had analyzed a total of 20 different rock samples from the Great Pyramid and had arrived at the conclusion that each stone had to have come from a different region in Egypt. If you think that perhaps each Egyptian village contributed a stone to the great building, you are wrong, because the tested samples individually contained ingredients from various regions. Normally, a natural granite block has a uniform density. The stones examined by Dr. Clem, on the other hand, were denser on the bottom than on the top, and also contained too many air bubbles. Professor David Davids lists two additional pieces of evidence which could, literally, cement his theory. In 1974, the famous Stanford Research Institute in California joined with scientists from Ain Shams University in Cairo to perform electromagnetic readings on the Great Pyramid. High-frequency waves were shot through the rocks, on the premise that they would not be reflected completely by dry monoliths. In fact, the scientists were quite certain that the readings would help them discover secret passages and chambers. Because the pyramid and the whole Giza plain were considered completely dry. Contrary to expectations, the readings were chaotic. The high-frequency waves were totally absorbed by the rock. What was the problem? The pyramid stones contained far more moisture than natural rock. Computers calculated that the Khafre pyramid alone contained several million liters of water. Professor David Davids concluded, "The blocks are artificial." The second piece of evidence could have been taken from an Agatha Christie novel. When Professor David Davids performed a microscopic analysis of rock samples from the Great Pyramid, he discovered traces of a human hair, and later an entire hair, 21 centimeters long. How did the hair end up in the rock? Maybe an Egyptian concrete mixer lost it. In the meantime, Professor David Davids mixed up a variety of Egyptian cements and concretes based on ancient Egyptian recipes. The new old age concrete is much harder and much more resistant to environmental factors than our modern concrete, because it dries faster and more thoroughly as a result of its chemical reactions. Is it surprising, then, that the company Geopolymer France has started to make concrete according to this old recipe? Dynamite Nobel also intends to manufacture the new cement mix, and Lone Star has introduced the harder and faster drying concrete mix in the United States. Pyramids in the fog. Once again, I was standing on the gentle hill just south of the pyramids at Giza, together with my assistant, Willy Dunenberger. It was early in the morning, before 6 o'clock, on May 12, 1988. Our smiling taxi driver, Kamal, had chauffeured us to the pyramids in the middle of the night because we wanted to photograph the sun rising over the pyramids. was in vain. Even though the pyramids were barely 300 meters away from us, we still could not see them 1 hour after sunrise. The magnificent buildings were shrouded with heavy gray curtains of dense fog, which steadfastly refused to lift. Even at this early hour, we were barraged by chattering tour guides. "Welcome to Egypt!" Only Horus, who sees everything, knows where these pesky pseudo-guards spend the night. They are omnipresent and annoying around the clock. We were shivering. Willie inspected the cameras while I trotted off about 50 meters in the direction of the pyramids. Undoubtedly, I figured the silhouettes of the symmetrical triangles would have to emerge from the fog at any moment. It was 8 o'clock now, and the fog was shimmering softly like white cotton candy. Reluctantly, a faint ray of light, pale as the moon, filtered through the steaming mist that tenaciously guarded the view of the pyramids. "I wonder if they had fog in Khufu's times," Willie asked. And I was wondering the same thing. In that case, the construction workers would not have been able to work in daylight for 12 hours. Finally, around 8:30, the shroud dissipated. 6 majestic triangles, 2 from each pyramid, shimmered in the early morning light with cool and imposing grandeur. The Egyptians say that man fears time, but time fears the pyramids. Kamal was negotiating with the bearded supervisor at the entrance to the pyramid. We wanted to get in before the imminent onslaught of tourist buses. We stopped for a long time in the grand gallery leading up to the king's chamber. It was perfectly silent. The electric bulbs painted the vertical side walls in a soft yellow light. I felt truly dwarfed in this gallery. The gigantic corridor ascending at a slant to the king's chamber is 46.61 meters long, 2.09 meters wide, and 8.53 meters high. Such measurements are nothing short of astounding. The lower part of the side walls, up to a height of 2.29 meters, consists of polished limestone monoliths. These are followed by 7 rows of enormous, corbelled beams terraced in such a way that each beam is 8 centimeters closer to the center than the previous one. Consequently, the passageway, which is wide at the bottom, converges at the top. The side walls are tapered toward the ceiling, which is made of horizontal slabs and is only 1.04 meters wide. This construction method is reminiscent of that of the Peruvian Incas, whose doors, windows, and corridors were always shaped like a trapezoid. The Grand Gallery is the most incredible construction achievement in human history. The realization must strike any visitor like lightning that all the theories about the pyramids can be nothing but fragments of the actual truth. To confound all of us know-it-alls even further, the granite beams facing each other along the side walls of the 8.5-meter-high vault are not horizontal, but slanted upward at the same angle as the corridor. The beams and slabs are polished so perfectly that it was difficult for us to see any joints even under the scrutiny of our flashlights. This is definitely a place where people are bound to suspect that the builders of the Great Pyramid may have received some outside help from extraterrestrial gods. We have forgotten how to be humble. We are continually told that mankind is the pinnacle of creation, the most highly evolved species. That is nonsense. Those who have lost the ability to wonder are unrealistic. Reality is superhuman, entwined with spiritual vibrations and interwoven with the next dimensions of the universe. I estimate that I have studied about 60 books of theories about the pyramids in the past 3 years. How was the Grand Gallery built? Nobody knows. All we have is gossip and unproven claims, but everybody is trying to throw their weight around as if they know what they are doing. as Oscar Wilde once said, "Blessed are those who have nothing to say and keep their mouths shut." A sarcophagus in the wrong place. On the south end, the Grand Gallery squeezes into an 8.4-meter-long tunnel leading to the King's Chamber. At first, we had to stoop, since the passage was only 1.12 meters high, but after about a meter, the low corridor opened up into a small room more than 3.5 meters high. 3-ton granite blocks originally barred access to the chamber at this point. After 3 meters, we had to stoop again. Kamal, who had not smiled in a long time, led the way, followed by Willie and me. Maybe it was my religious upbringing, maybe it was a certain respect, or maybe it was the fact that I was standing in the King's Chamber for the first time without other tourists. In any case, I felt as if I were standing in a cathedral. In a north-south direction, the rectangular room measures 5.22 meters, and east-to-west 10.47 meters. The chamber is 5.82 meters high. Given these sizable portions, I cannot understand why people insist on calling this a chamber. The walls of this hall consist of 5 enormous, horizontal, not vertical, granite beams. The floor is covered with granite as well. The walls feel like polished marble. The ceiling, made from pink Aswan granite, consists of 9 huge beams, joined together so perfectly that the seams are visible only as a thin, black thread at best. Hidden above the ceiling are 5 compartments designed to relieve the weight of the structure. They consist of monstrous blocks, each weighing more than 40 tons. Kamal coughed and pointed to the seamless, polished ceiling. "No one has managed anything like this since Khufu," he said. Willie aimed his flashlight at the ceiling, inspecting every centimeter of the phenomenal structure. Who came up with the idea that the hollow spaces above the ceiling were intended to relieve weight? He asked. Kamal's smile returned. What else could they be? Reluctantly, I interjected. The compartments above the King's Chamber remind me, spontaneously, of a Shinto temple, of a gate to another world. It seems to me that the archaeologists should quit interpreting them as structural relief. First of all, the compartments are not aligned with the pyramid axes. That is, they are not located under the apex of the pyramid. And secondly, and this appears much more significant to me, this weight relief theory implies that its builders knew the exact weight of the pyramid. How could that be in Khufu's time? Can you imagine what kind of mathematical knowledge would be required? Even today, we would need a computer to handle such complicated calculations. Would the King's Chamber have collapsed without the compartments above? Hardly. The space above the ceiling could have been covered by granite beams, whose weight would not have been resting on the ceiling. Besides, where else in the pyramid do we find such compartments to relieve the weight of the structure? Kamal silently walked to the black granite sarcophagus, which was only a few meters away, adjacent to the west wall of the chamber. Presumably, it used to be located in the center of the room. The sarcophagus, according to Professor Goyon, measures 2.28 by 0.98 by 1.04 meters. "There are many unresolved questions here," Kamal said. "Supposedly, the sarcophagus was found empty and without a lid. What is an empty sarcophagus good for? Besides, the measurements exceed the dimensions of the corridor that leads up to the Grand Gallery. How did the sarcophagus, which is made from a single stone, get into this room?" Willie had an answer. "I suppose they built the pyramid around the sarcophagus. The passageways in the Khafre and the Menkaure pyramids are also narrower than the sarcophaguses found there." Kamal thought for a while. "Maybe so," he finally said. But it still does not make sense that the Grand Gallery is much, much higher than the ascending corridor. It would have been easy to carry the sarcophagus vertically in the Grand Gallery, but it does not fit either way in the ascending corridor. I mean, it was a waste to build the Grand Gallery 8.5 meters high. Half of that would have been enough to get the sarcophagus through. And if the pyramid was built around the sarcophagus, like you think, why would they have needed the Grand Gallery? The facts defy all logic. Some experts have suggested that the Grand Gallery was intended as an elongated ascending hall through which the priests would march in solemn procession to pay their last respects to the deceased pharaoh. And granted, a solemn procession is very appropriate in such a situation. But first, the priests would have had to stoop and crawl, very unceremoniously, up the ascending corridor to reach the Grand Gallery. That does not seem appropriate. Willie said, "People who build with such mathematical finesse as these architect priests don't do anything unnecessary. Why would they build pseudo-corridors in empty compartments? It would have taken years to build this nonsense, and they didn't have years to waste, considering the tight schedule they were on." Kamal laughed. "You forget the grave robbers. It was necessary to confuse them." Willie looked at me, then at Kamal. "Grave robbers," he exclaimed, staring at Kamal across the sarcophagus, which rested between them like a stone bathtub. "Holy Horus! We are talking about the time period of Khufu, 2500 years B.C. The whole pyramid business started with the step pyramid at Saqqara. That's a piddling 80 years before Khufu. Where should the grave robbers have come from? The pyramids were impenetrable, like steel vaults." He is right, I thought. And Kamal must have thought the same thing, because he was stroking his chin pensively. On the other hand, the granite blocks obstructing the entrance to the corridor undeniably must have existed. The ascending corridor and the king's chamber were sealed off by these massive granite gates. It is enough to drive anybody up the wall. Why would such an elaborate security system have been required? Why did the pyramid need to be sealed if no pharaoh was ever buried in the Great Pyramid? Why did they devise traps and dead-end passages at a time when no grave robber had yet desecrated a pyramid? Two contrasting elements, vanity versus anonymity. The pyramid builders must have known human nature intimately. They must have been aware that scientific curiosity would consume future generations. After all, a thirst for knowledge is an integral part of human intelligence. At some point in the future, the builders must have figured people would force the pyramid open. Only then were they supposed to find the testament left behind by the ancient builders. But what is this testament? An empty sarcophagus? Voices, exclamations of surprise, and giggling sounds were buzzing into our solemn chamber. The first wave of tourists was storming the Grand Gallery. We escaped, past sweaty, expectant faces, out into the glaring sunlight. Every last molecule of fog had been devoured by the scorching sun. A papyrus vendor approached us with, "Welcome to Egypt!" While we were leafing through the colorful repertory of classical Egyptian motifs, and I was glancing rather absent-mindedly at the golden symbols before me, a thought crossed my mind. Hieroglyphs. There were no hieroglyphs in any of the halls, chambers, or corridors in the Grand Gallery. How could a pharaoh build the most monumental edifice on earth without applauding his own accomplishment? Without immortalizing his name even in the tiniest hieroglyph. This total lack of inscriptions is downright perverse, I mused. The anonymity of the building does not fit the character of the builder. Plinius felt that it was a most just punishment that the name and authors of so monstrous vanity should be buried in perpetual oblivion. Vanity and namelessness are totally incompatible. If Pharaoh Khufu was indeed a vain man, not to mention a tyrant and oppressor who, according to Herodotus, forced 100,000 slaves into labor on the Great Pyramid, accounts of his heroic deeds should have been scribbled all over the walls. It has been argued that the oppressed people knocked off the hieroglyphs praising their dictator. How could they have? And when? The pyramid was completely sealed off. No Vandals could have entered it to vent their anger on the pharaoh's inscriptions. Moreover, modern theory holds that no slaves were employed in the building of the pyramid. Karl-Heinz Schussler, an Egyptologist, states unequivocally that slavery did not exist in the ancient Egyptian Empire. If this grand edifice was completed without slaves, in voluntary and dedicated cooperation, it is even more unfathomable that there are no written messages anywhere. In a free enterprise situation, the craftsmen would have made certain to extol their employer's greatness. Kamal interrupted my train of thought. "Do you know how papyrus is made?" he asked. Between vendors and flocks of tourists, we wiggled our way back to the cab. "Papyrus isn't made," said Willie, jokingly, leaning from the back seat over Kamal's shoulder. "It grows on the banks of the Nile." "But how does the plant turn into a pliable sheet of parchment?" "Papyrus, forever along the Nile." Willie shrugged. Kamal accelerated and expertly threaded the cab between the clusters of people, camels, and cars onto the highway to Saqqara. We stopped briefly in front of a carpet-weaving business. Boys and girls, the latter in bright red dresses, were standing in front of a wall, guiding the shuttle through a jungle of warp threads. Boys with pitch-black hair, grayish shirts, and bare feet were operating the creaking wooden looms with swift, sure motions. The children were content. They laughed and sang, and casually thanked us for the backsheesh. Kamal explained that the children designed the patterns on the carpets themselves, and that they also determined the color combinations. 2 kilometers down the road, we visited one of the numerous papyrus factories in the Nile Valley. The aqueous papyrus plants, which may grow up to 4 meters high, have been processed in the same way for thousands of years. The stalk is cut into pieces of about 20 centimeters. The green bark is then stripped off with a knife. Originally, the elastic bark was used to make belts and sandals, but today it serves as kindling. The white pith inside the stalk is cut into thin strips with a knife and soaked in water for 6 days. The strips are then flattened in a press or with a rolling pin and arranged crosswise on a cotton sheet. They are next covered with another cotton sheet and pressed again. The sheets are changed frequently until the checkerboard pattern of papyrus strips is all dry. The dry strips stick to each other because the papyrus pith contains gelatin. It takes about 6 days of drying to produce one of the elastic but rather resilient sheets of papyrus. The finished paper can be painted easily with any kind of paint. The Egyptians have entrusted their messages to papyrus rolls for thousands of years. How come no word was ever written about the construction of the Great Pyramid? Why is there no reference anywhere to the creator of the most spectacular building of all times? No matter how we look at it, it just does not make sense. Some people have argued that Khufu was not buried in his own pyramid, but somewhere else. Why would he have chosen a different site? His burial vault was the safest in the world. At what point did he decide that he was not going to be entombed in his own pyramid? It is inconceivable that such a decision was made early on in the building process. It undoubtedly would have alienated the priests and architects. Waste all this tremendous effort? Never. With his edifice, Khufu planted a permanent marker in the Egyptian landscape. It is ludicrous to believe that he would have missed such an outstanding opportunity to perpetuate his own glory for all eternity. These facts leave us with only three alternatives. A. Khufu's sepulcher was plundered a long time ago. B. The real burial vault has not been discovered yet. C. The decision not to be buried in the pyramid was not Khufu's. I will discuss A and B shortly. The third scenario is contradicted by the monolithic reality of the pyramid. The Great Pyramid was sealed completely with huge monoliths and stone gates. The building was entirely finished. If the pyramid had not been completed at the time of Khufu's death, and his subjects hated the tyrannical ruler so much that they did not want his mummy inside the pyramid, why would they have finished the building? They would not have lifted a finger after the pharaoh's death. Khufu's successors, after all, had their own construction plans. Either Khufu is buried in his pyramid, or the pyramid does not belong to Khufu. Pyramid walls full of texts. A mere 200 years after Khufu's death, Egypt was ruled by Yunus, 2356 to 2323 BC, the last pharaoh of the 5th dynasty. His pyramid in Saqqara is only 47 meters wide and originally 43 meters high, minute as pyramids go, but it produced sensational findings. The walls of the sepulchre, the anteroom, and the entrance to the middle chamber are covered with hieroglyphic texts. The inscriptions are tightly packed in columns from right to left and from top to bottom. They are the oldest pyramid inscriptions, but not the only ones. Titi, Pepi I, Merner, and Pepi II, who succeeded Yunus in the 6th dynasty, 2323 to 2150 BC, all had the interior walls of their pyramids decorated with inscriptions. In 1965, 700 text fragments were found in the Titi Pyramid. 2 years later, French archaeologists entered the Pepi Pyramid and discovered walls and corridors covered with hieroglyphs. In February 1971, the Egyptologist Jean-Philippe Lauer and his team excavated the pyramid of Pepi's son, Merner. The light of their lamps fell on massive limestone blocks and the relief of a procession led by a winged genius. In one hand, the august divine creature carries a scepter with the animal god Seth on it. In the other, the Ankh hieroglyph, generally known as the symbol or key of life. In one of the lower tunnels, the archaeologists climbed over a stone trap that had been triggered by grave robbers and entered two rooms which were separated by huge monoliths weighing at least 30 tons each. The monoliths were arranged in the shape of the letter V, converging on the bottom and reaching toward the ceiling like an enormous victory sign. The stones were decorated with bright white stars, which seemed to be hanging in the room because of the V shape. Some of the walls were inscribed with texts. Others depicted mysterious rituals. There were animals, for example, cut in half by a painted line. Archaeologists believe that this was done to symbolically cripple the creatures, to render them harmless. In this way, the deceased pharaoh would not be bothered or attacked by animals on his journey through the realm of the gods. This argument is rather flimsy. If the Egyptians were afraid of animal magic, why would they even have painted animals? Our thinking has been molded by the old school of Egyptology. In many cases, these previous interpretations may be convincing and correct, but they do not fit our times. Pictures and hieroglyphs, which can be interpreted in various ways. Maybe the line cutting the animals in half was not intended to magically cripple them, but to express the fact that the animal was a hybrid, half earthly, half divine. Those who had hoped that the pyramid texts would shed some light on the construction of the pyramids or on Khufu were sorely disappointed. The hieroglyphs are poetic accounts about mythology, religion, magic, and the preeminent role of the cosmos. The experts agree that the texts, which originated at the end of the 5th and the beginning of the 6th dynasty, reflect fundamental religious beliefs dating back to a more ancient past. It is difficult to believe that the only purpose of the pyramid texts would be to communicate fictitious instructions for a life after death. We consider the laudations and compliments contained in the writings magical or ritual religious fantasies and aspirations on the part of the pharaoh. The oldest pyramid texts, for instance, describe the pharaoh's desire to meet the sun god Atum-Re in the heavens on his future journey. The scholars assure us that this has to be interpreted in a spiritual sense. Does it? The pharaoh and his priests had very specific ideas about their heavenly travels, although we may consider them childish. They did not travel by spirit. They traveled by ship. Space-age technology and children's toys. Why do our young ones enjoy playing with model railroads? Because the grown-ups are riding in real railroads. Why does a toddler scoot around the neighborhood in his bright yellow toy car, imitating engine noises and going beep, beep? Because his idols drive fancy cars that go beep, beep. Why do children run around their living rooms with helmets and built-in earphones, shooting laser guns and playing Conquerors from Planet XY? Because they watch grown-ups on TV doing the same thing. In my book, Hab Ich Mich Geirrt, I listed a number of cargo cults to demonstrate how native tribes in the present, just like ancient cultures, are imitating technologies they are unable to grasp. Inhabitants on the island of Vaywak constructed a ghost airport with airplane models made of wood and straw, because they were hoping to attract real airplanes in this manner. When the inhabitants of the New Guinea Highlands encountered white people for the first time in the 1930s, they thought that they were gods. Their mistaken belief was based mostly on the fact that the white people were wearing pants and carrying backpacks. 20 years later, an eyewitness said, "We thought that they carried their women in their backpacks, and we asked ourselves where the strange creatures left their excrements. Nothing could penetrate their pants." The natives of Markham Valley in the eastern highlands of New Guinea made radio stations out of bamboo and insulators out of rolled-up leaves. Tree trunks were used as antennas, and the jungle huts were connected by wires made from twisted plant fibers. Why? Scouts had observed the lifestyle of the white people along the coast. When the Russian Maclay arrived with his ship Vityaz in Bongo on the coast of New Guinea in September 1871, the locals watched him skeptically. Once they observed him walking around at night with a lantern, and from then on were convinced that he came from the moon. With great difficulty, Maclay explained to them that he was from Russia, not from the moon. But Russia meant nothing to them. In their eyes, the Russian was a very special creature, not only because his skin was white, but because he came in such a large vessel and appeared so suddenly. Without further ado, the natives declared him a god, Tamo Anut, and his ship became a divine vessel. One day, a wooden statue from a shipwreck was washed on shore by the waves, and the natives elected it as the symbol of their new god, Tamo Anut. Similar case histories have filled ethnological volumes. They all reflect the reactions of people faced with a technology beyond their comprehension. It makes no difference if the imitators are children or adults, because grown-ups act just like children when they don't understand a strange technology. What's new? Since the beginning of time and ever since, man has been an imitator. All of us have role models that we secretly strive to imitate. All of us would like to change jobs occasionally, or be someone else, if just for a day. We sit behind the wheel feeling like pilots, even though we know that our car is not going to lift off. We slip and slide awkwardly down the slope, wishing that we could be like the elite skiers. We have even fashioned our religious and cultural objects and robes after ancient models. Our ancestors also copied their knowledge from previous generations. Where is the original crown, scepter, or bishop staff that our imitations are based on? Who determined that certain rituals can only be performed in specifically prescribed robes? What are we imitating when we carry heaven through the streets during a Corpus Christi procession? Why is the sacred host locked up at the altar? Who gave us angels with wings and radiant halos? Where are the real models for the Ark of the Covenant, the high altar, and the heavenly throne? Where did we get those strange notions of ascension, original sin, and redemption? Our present and past knowledge allows us to examine the psychological profile of a pharaoh. He, or his ancestors, had witnessed real gods, extraterrestrials, sailing through the heavens in ships. That was news. Such events must have been the headlines of their oral and written traditions. At first, a handful of humans were chosen to serve these gods, thoroughly cleansed, of course. Dressed in special garments, of course. Separated from the divine beings by foyers and barriers, of course. The extraterrestrials did not take any chance of getting infected. Observation and ritual chores and purifications were at the root of the cult, which grew because of people's limited understanding, their natural penchant for imitation, and the gods' miraculous, mind-boggling devices. If it was reported that the gods had sailed through the heavens in ships, then the pharaoh, perforce, had to have a special bark as well. It is irrelevant whether the pharaoh believed he could fly in it after his death, or whether he was aware that it was never going to take off. What matters is the motivation behind it. The pharaohs did not build their sunbarks because of a philosophical idea, or because they observed the undulating movements of the central constellation. They were imitating something that they were told used to be reality. Humans sailed the Nile with their ships. Gods sailed the heavens. People were supposed to believe that their pharaoh was on his way to the gods in his splendid boat, that he was an old buddy, an equal partner of the divine creatures. A god pharaoh and his priests could never have admitted, even if they knew otherwise, that a human's reign ends with death. After all, gods never die. It is very appropriate, then, that skillfully crafted and ornately decorated sunbarks are found next to and under the pyramids. One such boat has been housed in an atrocious-looking building next to the Great Pyramid for years. Recently, with the help of electromagnetic waves, another one was located in the rocky ground. Such ships appear on temple reliefs from Aswan to the Nile Delta. Models are found in museums. Pharaoh Eunice, the one with the oldest pyramid texts, also had his own sunbark. The experts do not know anything specific about the purpose of these boats, even though popular literature wants us to believe otherwise. It is generally assumed that the pharaoh had one ship for the day and another for the night. The Egyptians suspected that the sun moves in the underworld at night, and consequently it was necessary to have two boats. However, the sunbarks are also viewed as boats filled with sacrificial offerings, as pilgrim ships, as soul ships, funerary boats, or royal inspection ferries. The pyramid texts, which make up the Egyptian Book of the Dead, permit a number of different interpretations. One example is the Ode to the Supreme Rule, in which the poet, or priest, invokes a goddess named the Eye of Horus. The goddess is asked to provide water, plants, and food for the pharaoh, and to open the gates of heaven so that the pharaoh may travel unhindered. Material nourishment for the fleeting Ka and Ba. Pyramid texts 273 and 274 in the Pyramid of Unis at Saqqara praise the heroic deeds which the deceased will perform in space. He is the Lord of all powers. His mother does not know his name. The glory of Unis is in heaven. His power is on the horizon. Unis is the heavenly bull. Those dwelling in heaven will serve Unis. The inscriptions are even more ambiguous in the actual burial vault of the Unis pyramid. They state that the pharaoh, like a cloud, is on his way to heaven, and that he is resting on a prepared seat in the ship of the sun god. Unis is described as the captain of the sun ship, who pleads for help in the darkness of the universe because the loneliness is great on the endless trip to the stellar constellations. How true. A ship conjures up travels. The pharaohs of the first dynasty undeniably saw themselves as the sons of the gods, just like the Japanese, Persian, and Ethiopian emperors have until very recently. For the son of a god, it was quite natural to return after death to his father, who was busy managing things up in heaven while his offspring was ruling on earth. On our planet, the firstborn prince inherits his father's kingdom, and the same was supposed to happen up above. The pyramid texts extolled the deceased pharaoh as the new ruler among the stars, as a potent executioner and judge to be feared by all the spirits and old gods. All of this is correct and hardly disputed by the experts. But the Egyptologists failed to perceive any real, practical value in the heavenly boats. Just remember the cargo cults. Symbolic objects are imitations of technology. No pharaoh had the courage to appear before his heavenly father equipped with nothing but Ka and Ba. He had to bring along his treasures for sacrifices and his bribes in particularly difficult cases. Real values in a real vessel. The child of today's oil sheik zooms around the palace in his battery-powered toy Rolls-Royce. The son of the heavenly gods zoomed around in his gilded sunbark. Astronauts in ancient Egypt? A similar interpretation is suggested by another decorative symbol, which appears on every ancient Egyptian temple and monument, the winged sun disk. In the 5th dynasty and thereafter, a golden disk or a sphere with colorful, spread wings symbolizes the sky-ruling falcon and the sun. However, the idea for this motif, which covers entire temple ceilings and countless temple entrances, dates back to prehistoric times, because a decoration from the first dynasty already shows a sunship on a pair of wings. After the notion of a sunship gliding along on wings ceased to have meaning, the pair of wings became joined by a golden disk. The image, which appears with geometrical precision above the entrances of halls and vaults, is often accompanied by inscriptions identifying it as Hut or api. The root word of hut means roughly to spread or to stretch, while the word api simply means to fly. The winged sun disk is associated with the god Horus, whose center of worship is located in the gigantic temple of Edfu on the western bank of the Nile between Aswan and Luxor. The present-day temple area, which is still very extensive, is very different from the ancient Horus temple. Inscriptions and archaeological excavations indicate that this complex was built on the ruins of an ancient holy site dedicated to Horus. Similarly, the legend of the winged sun disk, which was inscribed in one of the temple walls in Edfu, derives from ancient sources. The story describes how the god Re and his entourage landed west of the area east of the Pekanu Canal. Apparently, Ray's earthly representative, the Pharaoh, was in trouble and had asked the divine sky traveler for assistance in the fight against his enemies. The Holy Majesty of Ray Harmakis spoke to your holy person, Horhat. O, you sun-child, you exalted one whom I have created, speedily strike down the enemy who is before you. Then Horhat flew up to the sun in the shape of a large sun disk with wings. When he saw his enemies from aloft in the sky, he attacked them so fiercely from the front that they could not see with their eyes nor hear with their ears. In a very short time, no living body was left. Horhat, shining in bright colors, returned to the ship of Ray Harmakis in his shape as a large winged sun disk. Illogical logic. One must interpret this symbolically, I am told. It never ceases to amaze me what kinds of things one must do. Undeniably, hieroglyphs leave much leeway in their interpretation. Many years before Jean-François Champollion, the well-known hieroglyph translator, William Warburton, 1698-1779, Bishop of Gloucester in England, studied the Egyptian symbols and the ancient tales very thoroughly and recognized that the ancient Egyptians were using two different types of symbols, one kind to reveal the information they wanted to reveal, and a different kind to conceal certain things. That is a fact. But today, hieroglyphic texts are served up as an unambiguous certainty, even though interpretations could be as multicolored as the rainbow. More recently, ancient hieroglyphs have been discovered, which not even Champollion's translation theory has been able to crack. I find it difficult to accept the legend of the winged sun disk as an abstract tale, somewhere in the foggy realm of ancient religion. After assisting the pharaoh in the battle against his enemies, the flying god Ray announces matter-of-factly, "This is a nice place to live." He then names the surrounding regions and praises the gods of heavens and the gods of the earth. We should be allowed to read the original texts more, instead of being told what they mean. Horhat, he flew up toward the sun as a large winged disk. For this reason he has been called Lord of the Sky from that day on. The inscriptions at Edfu prove positively that the winged sun disk was worshipped because it represented divine intervention, not, as we are led to believe, because of the sun's existence in an imaginary world above and below. The Edfu text is very clear. Harmaki sailed in his ship, and he landed near the city Horus Throne. Thoth said, "The sender of rays, who is conceived by Ray, has defeated the enemies in his form. From this day on may he be called the sender of rays, who has been conceived by the mountain of light." Harmakis spoke to Thoth, "Mount this sun disk on all the sites of the gods in Lower Egypt, on all the sites of the gods in Upper Egypt, on all the sites of the gods." I would like to mention, by the way, that the term sender of rays is not my own invention, but was used in its German equivalent by Professor Heinrich Brugsch, who translated the Edfu text in 1870. What has happened to the winged sun disk in modern Egyptology? It has been turned into ceremonial mumbo-jumbo. The original image, a sunbark with wings, has been lost completely. The imagination of scholars unable to grasp ancient reality turns realities into myths, and the world is put straight again. But whose world? One particularly sensitive Egyptologist felt that the thought that some god actively intervened in human battles was unbearable, just as unbearable as my notion that extraterrestrials interfered in earthly affairs. Human logic is very fickle indeed. In the Old Testament, for example, God, who descends with smoke, fire, earthquakes, and noise, often joins his chosen people in battle. For real. It is considered logical there. Logical to whom? Fiat Lux. While the pyramid texts have been able to shed some light on the ancient Egyptians' simple line of reasoning, they have not been able to enlighten us. How did the Egyptians light the inside chambers of the pyramids? The countless hieroglyphs and artistic expressions on the walls definitely could not have been created in the dark. Were the decorations engraved on the monoliths while they were still outside, before they reached their final destination in a lightless vault? Possibly. To transport the stones, the construction crew would have to have wrapped the decorated walls and slabs in cotton. They could not afford to bump against anything. It is also possible that work was underway while the pyramid was still open, uncovered, and that the vaults were not sealed until the sculptors completed their delicate inscriptions. The lighting problem can be solved for above-ground pyramids, but not so for underground tunnels. Many pyramids are built on deep, excavated foundations, and the tombs in the Valley of the Kings near Luxor consisted of convoluted shafts which no sunlight ever touched. So how did the Egyptians light the walls and ceilings in these colorfully decorated sepulchres? Did each sculptor have his own torchbearer? Did the artists work by the light of oil lamps and wax kettles? Or did the builders set up a system of mirrors to coax sunlight into the dark dungeons? These are some of the questions Peter Krasa and Reinhard Habeck posed in their well-researched books. It is a lively, intelligent, and irreverent work that should not be missing from the library of anyone interested in Egypt. Krasa and Habeck point out that torches, oil lamps, or wax expel a black smoke and that consequently we should find soot residue on the walls and ceilings. But there is none. Is it mirrors, then? The iron mirrors available at the time were very rudimentary. They lost at least a third of the light with each reflection because of dispersion and absorption. After three mirrors, there would have been darkness. It is better to light a small light than to complain about the great darkness, Confucius once said. Imagine Cleopatra guiding her Roman friend Julius Caesar through the dark tunnels of the pyramid. Suddenly, a mysterious light shines from her hand, lighting up the walls and blinding the eyes of the startled Roman emperor. "What is this magical light you possess, my dear?" asks Caesar, apprehensively. "We call them flashlights," she replies, flattered. "Our ancestors have been using them for thousands of years. Don't you progressive Romans know this source of light?" Krasa and Habeck summarized their electrifying ideas in an article in Ancient Skies, the official publication of the Ancient Astronaut Society. The ancient Egyptians had electricity. Crazy? This claim can be substantiated rather easily. Our history books tell us that the effects of electricity were unknown until 1820, when they were discovered by H.C. Oersted, a Dane. Michael Faraday continued those studies, and Thomas Edison developed the incandescent light bulb in 1871. Thomas Edison was not the first. This historical interpretation is wrong. The National Museum in Baghdad, Iraq, displays a device consisting of a terracotta vase 18 centimeters high, a slightly shorter copper cylinder, and an oxidized iron rod with traces of bitumen and lead. This strange vase was unearthed in 1936 by a German archaeologist, Wilhelm Koenig, during his excavation of a Parthian settlement near Baghdad. Koenig suspected that the curious apparatus could be some kind of energy-producing battery. Ensuing studies confirmed his suspicions. Inside the vase, a thin sheet of copper had been molded into a cylinder with a length of approximately 12 centimeters and a diameter of about 2.5 centimeters. It had been welded with an alloy of pewter and lead. The cylinder bottom forms a tightly sealed copper cap, insulated on the inside with bitumen. At the top of the vase, the cylinder was also plugged with bitumen. An 11-centimeter-long iron rod protruded from deep inside the cylinder through the bitumen at the top of the cylinder, insulated against the copper. If the cylinder was filled with an acid or lye, it created a galvanic element presented in the identical combination which Galvani used for the battery named after him. In 1957, F. M. Gray, an American scientist at the high-tension lab of General Electric in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, proved that an electric current indeed flowed through the device and that the electricity was actually used. He succeeded in producing electricity with an exact replica of the apparatus and a copper sulfate solution. Thus he proved that the artifact found among the ruins of Kuchu Rabwa, as well as similar devices discovered in Seleucia along the Tigris, and in neighboring Ctesiphon, was an electrical battery. Were similar devices used by the Egyptians? Ancient wall reliefs in a subterranean crypt in Dendura, 70 kilometers north of Luxor, confirm the claims made by Crassa and Habeck. The temple complex of Dendura is dedicated primarily to the goddess Hathor. In ancient times, she was considered the sky goddess and mother of the sun god Horns. Because the Egyptians saw a gigantic cow image in the night sky, the goddess Hathor was portrayed as a cow in addition to her human form. As a human, she was always depicted with the horns of a cow and a sun disk. She is the goddess of dance, music, love, science, and astronomy. Light for the Pharaoh. We know from Mastaba that Dendura, the temple of the goddess Hathor, was known in the Old Kingdom. Over the course of time, the temple complex lost some of its significance until it was restored and rebuilt during the Ptolemaic period. Today, the temple structures are definitely worth visiting. Colonnades, walls, and ceilings grant us insights into the religious ideas of the Egyptians of the Greco-Roman period, which, of course, were based on more ancient models. Dendera is also the only site in Egypt with a complete zodiac of the 36 decans of the Egyptian year. The exquisite relief, with its 12 main figures and mathematical and astronomical signs, was removed from a temple ceiling in Dendera in the last century and sold to King Louis XVIII for 150,000 francs. It can be viewed at the Louvre in Paris. Astronomers who studied the zodiac of Dendera dated it to 700 BC. Others placed it around 3733 BC. Dendera is also unique because of its subterranean chambers and their mysterious wall reliefs, reminding us of long-forgotten times. One of these vaults measures about 4.6 by 1.12 meters and can be accessed only through a small opening. The room has a low ceiling. The air is stale and laced with the smell of dried urine from the guards who occasionally use it as a urinal. Crassa and Habeck describe the walls as decorated with human figures next to bulb-like objects reminiscent of oversized light bulbs. Inside these bulbs, there are snakes in wavy lines. The snakes' pointed tails issue from a lotus flower, which, without much imagination, can be interpreted as the socket of the bulb. Something similar to a wire leads to a small box on which the air god is kneeling. Adjacent to it stands a two-armed jet pillar as a symbol of power, which is connected to the snake. Also remarkable is the baboon-like demon holding two knives in his hands, which are interpreted as a protective and defensive power. The experts, who should know, are at a loss to explain the reliefs in this small, lightless chamber. They call it a cult room, a library, an archive, or a storage room for storing cult objects. A storage room or a library that is accessible only through a tiny opening? Ridiculous. The pictures on the walls are similarly mystifying to the experts. What is a jet pillar? A symbol for continuity. A symbol for eternity. A prehistoric fetish. A leafless tree. A notched pole. A fertility symbol. The symbolic ear of a plant. Crassa and Habeck, more in tune with reason, interpret it as an insulator. Why not? The Old Kingdom had priests of the Venerable Jet. Even the main god Ptah was called Venerable Jet. A specific rite was performed in Memphis to erect the Jet Pillar. It was executed by the king personally with the assistance of priests. A Jet Pillar was something very special. Only certain insiders were allowed to handle it. Jet pillars were found even under the oldest pyramid, the Pyramid of Djoser in Saqqara. Looking at the melodramatic interpretations of this curious object, someone like me is bound to start chuckling. What else are we going to construe in our heads before we truly open our eyes and see things the way they are? Hidden way back in the abstruse thoughts of well-respected scholars, the beliefs of ancient Egyptians are reconstructed, while out in the open, in the reality of our century, cargo cults crop up all over. It is blatantly obvious that the Jet Pillar is a representation of misunderstood technology. Even the deaf can see it, and the blind can feel it. How did the prophet Isaiah put it in the Old Testament? Shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes. The walls of the crypt below Dendera celebrate a secret science, the knowledge of electricity. I do not expect the experts to share my opinion that the ancient Egyptians used electricity, but it is a shame that, according to Goethe, intelligent people least abandon their sound judgment when they are wrong. Pyramid Magic. I am standing in an 8-meter-high pyramid, oriented precisely according to the 4 cardinal points. Above me, 4 light gray triangles converge at the top of the pyramid. Beige, wall-to-wall carpeting covers the floor. Purple pillows are scattered across the floor like patches of flowers. A handful of people, men and women, are sitting on some of the pillows, silently meditating. I scan the pyramid walls with my eyes. 8 small windows have been inserted at the bottom of each triangular wall, for a total of 32 windows. My feet are resting on a 6-point golden star built into the floor. A small glass pyramid is sitting in each corner of the pyramid. The inside of the pyramid, faintly lit, is bathed in gentle yellow tones. Someone closes the foam-padded doors. The music begins. At first, it is a calm, rustling sound, a distant melody playfully enveloping me like a murmuring brook. Then it becomes a roaring and trembling that vibrates from every pyramid surface, flooding my senses and carrying me off into a broiling universe of vibrations. I am enchanted, unable to move away from my star, as Anton Dvorak's New World Symphony, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, penetrates every fiber of my body. I remain motionless, frozen, lost in thought, even after the music culminates in a furious crescendo. The sudden silence is like a shock. I feel as if my brain is being dragged through a car wash. 1,000 different ideas and inspirations flash through my head, stir me up, pull me away from this world, out into the star-spangled night sky. Never have I been more aware that the phrase, "God is dead," could only have arisen from egocentric brains. This God, who they believe is dead, is all around me, in every molecule, every atom of my existence. While my body is still attached to the floor of the pyramid, my mind is soaring above the top of the pyramid. I perceive myself as part of the universe, as a flash of lightning spreading in all directions at the speed of light. I have no eyes, yet I recognize the milky white light falling on the pyramid below. I have no ears, yet I hear, with sweeping intensity, the flowing melodies of Glassworks by Philip Glass, which now surround the pyramid. In the same instant, I realize with astonishment that I cannot possibly know the title of the composition, that I have never in my life heard of a composer named Philip Glass. What is happening? Where does this supernatural awareness come from, which permeates everything and is in all places at the same time? Did somebody spike my drink with a drug? Am I the victim of a spiritual force reaching out for me? I dive back down into my body, trembling like a wet poodle, and quietly leave the pyramid. Outside, I meet the sound technician, the young man who installed the quadraphonic system inside the Itora pyramid on the island of Lanzarote. Itora is an esoteric convention center. I had been invited there for some lectures. It is a paradise without any mosquitoes or other pests. What is the name of the piece that is playing in the pyramid right now? Glassworks by Philip Glass. I must compliment you on the acoustics. You must have measured everything very carefully. The sound technician laughed. Nothing was measured at all. I rely on my ear. Besides, there is the pyramid effect. The pyramid effect. The discovery of this effect sounds like a sentimental fairy tale. Once upon a time, on the flowery Côte d'Azur in Nice, there was a hardware store owner named Antoine Bovy. But Monsieur Bovy aspired to something higher than selling screws and nuts. He was a relentless tinker and inventor, and even in the 1930s, when no one had heard the term New Age yet, Antoine Bovy was the leader of an esoteric circle. Not surprisingly, Monsieur Bovy's store sold more than iron bars and tools. It sold special magnetic pendulums, biometers, invented by Bovy himself, and various devices. During a trip to Egypt, which, among other places, brought him to the Great Pyramid of Giza, Bovy made a curious discovery, one that other tourists pass by without a second thought. A tiny desert mouse was lying dead on the floor of the king's chamber. Bovy speculated on how this small creature had entered the age-old building. Antoine Bovy gently nudged the dead mouse with his foot. He wanted to see if bugs or ants had found their way to the animal corpse. Monsieur Bovy searched the floor carefully for clues, turned the mouse over again and again, then finally bent down to pick it up. The realization struck him like lightning. The desert mouse was light as a feather, shrunk, and mummified. What mysterious forces were behind this discovery? Why did the dead mouse show no signs of decay? Upon his return home, Monsieur Bovy constructed a pyramid model out of iron bars and wood. Light as it was, the dead mouse in the Great Pyramid weighed heavily on his mind. Intuitively, he did the right thing from the very beginning. Antoine Bovy arranged his pyramid in a north-south direction, just like the original pyramid in Giza. He then placed a small wooden podium inside the pyramid, one-third the height of the pyramid. The podium was intended to represent the site of the king's chamber, which is one-third above the foundation of the Great Pyramid. Finally, following his intuition, and the fact that beef stew was planned for dinner, Antoine Bovy placed a small piece of beef on the podium. Ordinarily, the meat should have started to stink after a few days, but it did not. It became increasingly drier, more and more desiccated, as if an invisible force was drawing all fluid out of the beef chunk. Bovy observed the mummification with irritation. Then he initiated a whole series of experiments with and without the model pyramid. All organic substances inside the pyramid were dehydrated. Those outside the pyramid rotted. Sounds logical to me, I said when I read the story for the first time.